You might have noticed, newspapers, TV stations, and other news outlets are dropping like flies in Canada these days. Whoops, there goes another one. But that's okay, because it leaves more room for independent media, like Ravel.ca. You can join the independent media revolution too. Go to www.ravel.ca/donate.
This is a Ravel Podcast Network show.
Ravel.ca.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This is a special episode of Groundwire commemorating Prisoner Justice Day. This episode of Groundwire was produced at community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe peoples and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We are your hosts. My name is Rachel Dunsmore.
And my name is Susan Hubert. In this episode,
data that we're seeing and understanding, learning to understand, is that fentanyl is actually being used in a wide range of street drugs.
I see the parallels between CFS, residential schools, and prisons. And It's just another form of trying to kill the Indian in the child, but well, it's an adult now.
The problem is the very nature of this professionalization of the elite running the NGOs and solidarity networks.
But first, here are the headlines. On August 2nd, Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson committed to developing 100% social housing that is affordable at welfare rates at 58 Hastings in the downtown east side.
We still have 1,847 minimum homeless people in Vancouver, and we demand action on this issue right now. Here's Mayor Robertson.
Yeah! We've come to an agreement to make sure that the 58 West Hastings site is 100% social housing. We want to see welfare rates. We've lost so much of the housing here in Vancouver that was at shelter rates, partly because of affordability in Vancouver, partly because welfare rates have been frozen for so many years. So part of this is making sure this building will be available for people who are on welfare, who are on pensions, and cannot afford more than that. We want to work together with the community to push on the BC government. Whoever the next government elected next year is, they have to commit to raising shelter rates so people can afford to live in this province. They have to commit to solving homelessness in Vancouver, right across the province. We have homeless camps all over the province right now, and we need to be sure the BC government is focused on solving homelessness, building the social housing that we need here on the streets of Vancouver. We have 20 sites in Vancouver. We've asked the BC government and the federal government to partner with us to build affordable social housing for people in our city.
58 Hastings has been the site of many tent cities dating back to 2008, including the Olympic Village Tent City. The current tent city has been going on since early July. A member of the Chinatown Action Group shared her thoughts on the announcement.
We're being kind to the willingness and the commitment from the mayor to work with the community to build social housing that's much needed. It's not enough by any means, but it's an important first step.
At a meeting on August 3rd, community members were also informed by City Councillor Andrea Reimer of the timeline for the rezoning process.
What we can commit to is getting it to rezoning by the end of... we'd actually prefer to get it there before the provincial election, because the closer it is to the provincial election, the more chance we have of getting money out of the province. So we'll make the commitment to by the end of June 2017 is what we can commit to.
Many members of the downtown east side were adamant that Tent City would remain at 58 Hastings until their housing needs were met. Thank you to Gunarji O'Sullivan of Vancouver Co-op Radio for the audio used in that report.
In the afternoon of Monday, August 8th, youth from Grassy Narrows First Nation organized a march through the streets of Kenora, Ontario, calling for the cleanup of the English Wabagoon River system, which has been contaminated by mercury for over 50 years. about 3 dozen people gathered at the Ministry of the Environment and Climate Change office in the early afternoon and walked the distance to the offices of provincial NDP representative Sarah Campbell. The youth were demanding the Ontario provincial government take action after a recent expert report revealed that the river system can be safely remediated. Kathleen Wynne's Liberals have yet to commit to a full cleanup. The march was a scaled-down follow-up to last June's River Run March in Toronto, where about 1,000 people made the same demand of the Premier. The contamination began between 1962 and 1970, when a Dryden pulp and paper mill dumped 9,000 kilograms of mercury into the river system. Charisse Bruce, one of the youth organizers, said in a press release, quote, "We know that our water can be cleaned, and we're not going to stop rallying until we get what we deserve," unquote.
That's it for the headlines, and now it's time for our feature stories. In Winnipeg, concerned community members marked Prisoner Justice Day with a 24-hour vigil outside the city's penal detention facility for an inmate who died in custody there under questionable circumstances. The vigil provides the backdrop for the following comprehensive report by Stéphane Doucette from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. This feature links the origins of Prisoner Justice Day to today's struggles for justice.
Every year on August 10th, prisoners across Canada commemorate Prisoner Justice Day by fasting, refusing to work, and often not leaving their cells. 2016 marked the 31st year of this tradition, which started at the Millhaven Institution in southern Ontario. Bob Gaucher is a retired professor from the University of Ottawa and a founder of the Journal of Prisoners on Prison, a long-running journal which attempted to bridge communication gaps between the incarcerated and their supporters on the outside. His 1991 article, Organizing Inside, Prison Justice Day, A Nonviolent Response to Penal Repression, published in the Journal of Prisoners on Prison, explores the historical and social context that led to the establishment of Prisoner Justice Day, as it's now called. It also talks about how prisoners organized in the face of a rapidly changing prison environment where guards had more power than ever, leading to more torture, isolation, and deaths. I got to talk to Bob on August 1st.
You know, in the 1960s, the penitentiary service stopped really trying to do penal reform. They started to really waver over it all. I think a really important aspect was that guards were unionized in the Public Service Alliance of Canada in 1968, and they really tried to muscle in and take control of the institutions. So guys in Millhaven, they started with the Quarter Century Group. They were older guys doing a lot of time. And it morphed into the Odyssey Group. And they were trying to figure out how to deal with the violence that was going on, how to calm it down, and how to get the public on their side. And so the Odyssey Group thought of the idea of Prison Justice Day. In 1975, Eddie Nalin had died in his cell in the special handling unit in the hole. So in 1976, August 10th, it was a Memorial Day in Millhaven for the death of Eddie Nalin.
Still today, over 3 decades after the establishment of Prisoner Justice Day, prisons remain an area where abuse runs rampant with no accountability. Guards kill with beatings and neglect, both intentional and systemic, and those who die are, like the prison population itself, mostly Indigenous. In Winnipeg, Prisoner Justice Day was marked by a 24-hour vigil outside the Winnipeg Remand Center, a temporary holding facility which holds people awaiting bail, who've been denied bail, or who are in some sort of limbo. Errol Green, a 26-year-old father of three with another on the way, died at the Remand Center last May when he was denied his epilepsy medication, and he died as a result of the lack of medical attention when he suffered seizures. His family and supporters held space outside the Remand Center for 24 hours to mark PJD as well as call for justice. Cheryl James is one of those supporters. Her sister, Canoe James, died in January 2013 in the Regional Psychiatric Center in Saskatoon, which is a federal prison. Cheryl spoke of the impact of the prison system on Indigenous peoples and of the ways people most affected by the system are working together to fight it.
I see the parallels between CFS residential schools and prisons, and it's just another form of trying to kill the Indian in the child, but well, it's an adult now. And it's just another way of getting them away from, like, tearing them away from the community, pulling them away from their families, breaking those bonds, and then, you know, then they have to try and come back to the community and, you know, try and rebuild those relationships and that they've lost and that were already affected by residential schools. And one of the most important thing that I see is that happening now is that families, well, they've been connecting for a while, but I'm seeing since our family has been affected that it's unbelievable how many families that we know that have been affected by this. And and it's sad, but it's good that we are connecting, because we can help each other. We can help each other navigate these systems, or try and help each other navigate these systems. Yeah, I see a lot of our grassroots people out there, you know, on the land, on the streets, in the back lanes, wherever, that are doing the work that needs to be done, but aren't, that are doing it just because they have love for the people, love for the land. Yeah, those are the people we need to tap into.
This piece was prepared at CKUW Studios 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
In recent years, there has been a sharp increase in deaths related to the use of the synthetic opioid fentanyl. Grant Banchard of CFUR, Prince George, British Columbia, brings us an in-depth look at the ways that fentanyl use is currently impacting the community.
It's not a new message. Drug use can harm and even kill. Here in Canada, we have seen a shift away from the fear of drugs, which controlled much of the 1980s and 90s. We're even considering the legalization of marijuana, something that would have never been considered by our parents' generation. However, one drug is showing that the reality of drug use can have tragic effects. Now, that drug is fentanyl, and across Canada, we've seen major effects by it. Many people have died from it. To put some numbers into perspective, if we look at the BC Coroner's report, this year, 148 people have died so far. Over the same time period in 2015, 49 people have died. 2014, 27 people died. 2013, 21 people died. And in 2012, over the same time period as this year, only one person has died of fentanyl. So the numbers are rising. Here in Prince George, we are no exception to the effects of fentanyl and addictions. So I went to a center which deals with trying to get people off of drugs, Baldy Hughes Therapeutic Community and Farm, and spoke with some of the staff and people staying there. One gentleman, who will remain anonymous, gave me a very compelling and heart-wrenching story about his journey.
You know, I got into opiates when I was 19 years old. I wasn't into drugs when I was 12. But when I started doing opiates, especially fentanyl, that's when my life started to spiral, like, out of control. Very expensive, very strong. I was doing it in its purest form when I started. It wasn't until I started using it with different drugs, like they have those green Oxycontin, the fake pills, that I started seeing... you know, people overdose. Okay. A close friend of mine overdose. You know, for me, it was just a way to escape my problems. But really, I was just adding to my problems. Mm-hmm. You know, usually with addiction, it stems from somebody, you know, having something tragic happen to them when they're a kid, or you know, trying to deal with fear. It was both for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was molested as a kid when I was 6 years old. I had lots of fears of less than confrontation, and that was a way for me to deal with it. But in the end, I lost everything except for my family.
Now, I also spoke with some of the staff there as well. Sean Farrell, which is a communications director of Baldy Hughes, gave us the breakdown of what they know about fentanyl, especially what's happening in British Columbia.
Sure. Well, fentanyl is a synthetic painkiller, and it's having a remarkable impact on basically society in British Columbia right now. Most reports are indicating that it's coming directly from Asia into North America. So obviously, West Coast provinces and states are being hit first with this. The data that we're seeing and understanding, learning to understand, is that fentanyl is actually being used in a wide range of street drugs, of illegal drugs right now.
Okay.
It's very inexpensive to import, and in its purest form, it's quite dense, it's quite small. So dealers don't actually need to import huge amounts, which means it's kind of coming in under the radar.
There has also been a shift in the age demographics at Baldy Hughes. Robert Trevally, who's the executive director there, was with us as well, and he gave us this comment about what's happened there.
40%, the average age right now, 40% of them are 29 years of age.
Oh, wow.
And that's the average.
Under age. 29.
Under 29.
Under 29. Yeah. Under 29. So once upon a time, if we had somebody in their 20s here, it was rare. Now, basically, the largest age bracket we're seeing are age 19 to 29.
And here's a comment about why that resident who we were speaking with earlier thought fentanyl was spreading so fast, especially with young people.
You know, you're seeing lots of people, especially where I'm from, driving around and just pulling over when they see young people and asking them, like, do you party? Would you like this? And it's almost like getting them on that hook. You give it to them, and once you're in that addiction, I can't even explain it. Like, the way you need the drug, you will do anything to get that drug. So I think it's just introducing it to the community, getting it out there by word of mouth, and from there it goes downhill.
There are many people trying to deal with fentanyl, but it's still unclear what the long-term effect will be on our community. For CFUR 88.7 FM, I am Grant Bashand.
Our last feature comes from CKUT Radio in Montreal at the World Social Forum. The decision to hold the 2016 event in Montreal has recently made headlines due to the fact that many participants were denied entry visas by Canada. This will be the first time since the forum's inception in 2001 that the forum is being held in a G7 country. The World Social Forum's website estimated that 80% of participants this year will come from Quebec, 10% from the rest of Canada and the U.S., and 10% from the rest of the world. 70% of visa applications by Global South delegates to the World Social Forum were denied by Canadian embassies.
Here we have Aziz Salmanfall.
Well, I'm a member of the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa. We are not participating in the World Social Forum, but I share CIRFA, which is the Internationalist Center, and we were part of the World Social Forum for a while. From Porto Alegre to Dubai, Dakar, or Tunis, most of the World Social Forum were held in southern country. So for the first time, it's held in a northern country. We have expressed very clearly in the very beginning of the process that it would be a pity to not have the southern organization attending because of one of the structural problems in the polarized world capitalist system, mainly capital, commodities can circulate, human beings are still restricted. We were fearing that most of our delegation from Latin America, from Asia, or from Africa will not be granted any visa access. And that argument was dismissed under the ground that, they will have some deal with the immigration policy here to grant a visa our partners. So after months and months of preparation, there were indications that it will be very unlikely that most of these people will attend. I think then we should have stopped and say, well, we don't have the good condition to have something, the scale of the World Social Forum. But I think the problem is deeper than just a technical and administrative. The problem is the very nature of this professionalization of the elite running the NGOs and solidarity networks. Like, you have a core of people who, with subsidies, with access to traveling and so on, end up setting the agenda.
We'll now hear from Sarah Seltani. She is one of the organizers that helped bring the World Social Forum to Montreal.
We've been aware since we proposed the candidacy of Montreal to the International Council that the visa would be a big issue for getting people into Canada. I think as an organizational collective, we did everything we could. I have to remind that we're mostly majoritively a volunteer collective, and everyone involved in these projects and campaigns are mostly like 90% volunteers. So what we did concretely is we had teams working on visa to help people. So we had 30 people that were trained to assist anyone that was doing a visa request. We also did a call to all the embassies in the world to inform them that there was going to be a lot of visa requests for the World Social Forum. And we have given more than 2,000 letters of invitation to support the request of anyone that wanted to come to the World Social Forum. But what is the most surprising is that people that were supported by a local organization financially and for the housing and for their visa file were denied requests. They were denied visa, even though they had the support of a social organization here in Quebec or in Canada or even outside of Canada. So I think we did our best we could have done more, of course, but we did our best we could in our resources. But at the end of the day, we are faced to the denials of the request.
On Friday, August 12th, a demonstration was held on the streets of Montreal in protest to the denial of visas to so many delegates. We'll first hear from Sphinx Eben.
What you're standing up for is not just the people who missed the opportunity to join other activists and be part of this great global conversation. You're standing up for what has been an attempt at sabotaging the possibility for social justice activists to unite and redefine a new world as we all watch capitalism crashing over our heads with one crisis after another.
99% of the delegation from Kenya, to which Alex Kanye was a part, did not receive visas from the Canadian government. Here he is speaking at that same demonstration.
We condemn these acts of social cleansing, impunity, and the 1% trying to disrupt social movements all over.
Canada did profit from these visa applications. With more, here's Gretchen King.
Each visa application cost at least $200, and that's a theft from social movements worldwide who supported delegates to come here who have been refused. This represents a sabotage of the World Social Forum process by Canada. It was a decided act by Canada, and Canada made money in the process.
The World Media Forum has created a petition in response to these visa denials. Check it out at mayfirst.org/visa.
Now it's time for our community radio report. Prisoner Justice Day has been commemorated since 1974, and community radio has always been there to amplify the voice of people seeking reform and abolition of the prison system, both from the inside and out. Our community radio report this week highlights Prisoner Justice Day programming from across the country this year and the tradition of community radio with this kind of programming.
2016 marks the 41st annual Prisoners Justice Day, which began in commemoration of Eddie Nalin, a prisoner who bled to death in the segregation unit of Millhaven Prison in the Kingston area on August 10, 1974. Community radio stations across the country have been using the airwaves to commemorate, remember, and call to action on Prisoners Justice Day. To commemorate Prisoner Justice Day 2016, we will hear excerpts from special programming produced by community radio stations across the country. Volunteers at CKUT Community Radio in Montreal recorded and aired content from a local Prisoner Justice Day punk show organized by the Termite Collective. In between show sets, members of the Termite Collective shared the history of Prisoners Justice Day with the audience. Here's an excerpt.
I also wanted to talk about a little bit of the context of Prison Justice Day. Eddie Nalin, when he was there in 1974 in Millhaven, he was among prisoners who were transferred from Kingston. And Kingston was the penitentiary, our oldest penitentiary here, 1835, which was asked to be dismantled, by the way, by all kinds of folks about 10 years later, a call for abolition, by the way. And there was Kingston riots, so they took everybody who they thought were organizing in Kingston and brought them all to Millhaven that wasn't built, hadn't been finished. And as the story goes, what I've been told by folks on inside who maybe were not in at the time, but did time with folks who had been there, was there were, you know, the prisoners were coming into Millhaven and there were two lines of guards and they were just beating them as they were walking into Millhaven. That's that context. The other thing is that folks in Millhaven had organized with folks outside, and that was important for people on the outside to know what was going on inside, because had that not happened, Prison Justice Day would have been a lot more difficult for it to have been recognized.
Stations also dedicate portions of Prisoners Justice Day programming to messages and music requests by and for prisoners and their loved ones and supporters in the community. Here is an excerpt from CFRC in Kingston, Ontario, location of one of the oldest continuous use prisons in the world.
And we're into the request portion of the evening. We have quite a few coming up. The first one here is an essay we mentioned by Chester Abbotsbury, frequent collaborator and contributor to our programming. It's dedicated to the fond memory of Cliff Fireman Skadesh Nim Navo, passed away January 29th, 2016. Last rites 3, a funeral shroud of secrecy and callousness. 65 of us have died last year in prison. I've said it before, but it needs repeating. Leaving this world from behind bars may set the soul free, but in another way, you never really get out. Dying in prison means that whatever length your bit is, it gets instantly changed to a life sentence. As we fast and remember our fallen, we also need to seek justice for their families. We need to think about how our own are criminalized and how our incarceration perpetuates the marginalization and lack of opportunity which brought us here. We need to question this system and demand its abolition in the face of the fact that it continues to operate through the dehumanization and emotional incarceration of the people we hold most dear.
Prisoners Justice Day programming is also an opportunity to explore the larger context of prisoner justice and other forms of incarceration and detention, such as death in custody, immigration detention, the criminalization of sex work, the reopening of prison farms, and police brutality. Our final excerpt comes from Guelph Community Radio CFRU's Special Prisoner Justice Day programming, which spotlighted the issue of immigration detention.
The Canadian government came up with basically two kinds of laws. Okay, you are undocumented here, so therefore you are at flight risk, because they would think they think that if you were to leave the country, you would not show for the deportation process. And secondly, you violated Canadian law because you were here. You've been here for so long. Minus the criminal process, what happens is now you're undocumented because you violated Canadian law. So they strip you out of your permanent residency and then try to take you back. But if your country can't take you back, that means that you're in diplomatic limbo. Canada is not going to let you out of prison because Canada thinks that you are a danger to the public. So that's my definition of immigration detention.
Prisoner Justice Day is not the only day to listen to stories about the prison justice movement, prison reform, and abolition. Many community radio stations across the country air weekly prisoner justice and prison radio programs. Tune in to your local station to listen, or better yet, get involved and create your own message of support and solidarity for prisoners over the air.
That community radio report was produced by Om Salma Rahimtullah in Toronto, Ontario, on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe peoples and the homeland of the Métis Nation.
Headlines this week were written by Michael Welch and Carly Forbes. We thank all of our contributors in this episode, as well as Gretchen King, Aaron Lakoff, Christopher Curry, Candace Moores, Maria Forti, Cameron Willis, and Stefan Doucette. My name is Susan Hubert.
And my name is Rachel Dunsmore. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwirenews.ca, or podcast at rabble.ca.